inside her mouth. She took in a deep breath, her eyes closing briefly as if she was trying to collect herself. There are other historians in this company who talk about the children. I am way too emotional to do that, she said. Infant mortality rates in the colony were high, and infanticide, unclear if by the masters or the mother, was a regular practice. What I will tell you is that many enslaved children were not allowed to breastfeed, Damaris said. Some mothers were enlisted as wet nurses for white children. Others were prevented from breastfeeding because they were expected to work without interruption. Damaris also told us about the damage that researchers found in the bodies of young people, including cases of osteoarthritis, a condition that normally doesn't affect people until they are beyond their 50s. But here, they saw osteoarthritis in the remains of children as young as 16. Damaris's face, ever so briefly, became swollen with grief before she quickly recomposed herself. Historian Christopher Moore, a descendant of Groot Manuel, or Big Manuel, who was one of the first 11 enslaved Africans brought to the city of New York, wrote that those burying their loved ones in the cemetery did their best to use traditional practices, but were limited by stringent legal restrictions that dictated the lives and movements of black people at the time. No more than 12 people were allowed to take part in funeral processions or graveside services at a given time. Burials could not take place at night, despite being a standard element of many African burial practices. Black people who were enslaved needed a written pass to travel more than 1 mile away from their homes. The distance between their homes and the cemetery was often greater than 1 mile. The harm done did not end after a person's funeral, but continued after their death. It was not uncommon for local doctors and medical students to illegally exhume bodies from the cemetery to use them for dissections and experiments. In 2003, after time at the lab at Howard University, the remains from the African burial ground returned to New York City in a grand ceremony. Each of the 419 sets of remains was placed in its own hand-carved coffin made in Ghana. The coffins were split between 7 crypts. Each crypt, along with nearly 8,000 handwritten letters from the living to the African ancestors, was lowered into the ground and marked with 7 burial mounds. The site was designated a National Historic Landmark in 1993, and in 2006, it was designated a national monument by President George W. Bush. The discovery of the African burial ground was central to New York having to more honestly account for its history, not sidestepping its slaveholding past, and according to a 1993 article in the magazine Archaeology, challenged the popular belief that there was no slavery in colonial New York. I looked at the burial mounds behind Damaris, observing the way they rose and fell like waves. I thought of all that lay beneath the layers of grass and soil and stone, the history, the stories. If it were not for the federal law mandating assessment prior to construction, this burial ground might have been forgotten beneath the pavement, lost under the shadow of skyscrapers. I couldn't help but wonder how many more buried, forgotten memorials there were across the country. I'd like to end my tour here, Damaris said. Thank you for being uncomfortable with me. She looked at each of us and clasped her hands together, lifting and dropping them between each word to create the effect of punctuating her remarks. If there's anything I can leave you with, question everything. Myself, everything you read, everything you hear. Fact check, fact check, fact check. She pulled her hands apart and swept them across each other. Don't believe anything if it makes you comfortable. Before leaving to catch my train, I asked Damaris if there was anywhere else in the city I should visit. Central Park, she said. Central Park was built on Seneca Village, which was a neighborhood for free black people in the 19th century. That was their settlement. That was their territory, she told me. I don't think a lot of people know that. So you go to Central Park, it's one of the most visited places in the United States of America, and people don't know that they're sitting on the remains. A few weeks later, I made my way to the corner of West 85th and Central Park West. The air was biting, and the sky was a lustrous sheet of winter gray. Steam billowed out from an open manhole surrounded by striped orange and white barricades. Red double-decker buses made wide left turns, and yellow taxis sped around them. On one side of the street were residential apartments listed at $3 to $4 million, and on the other side was an Upper West Side entrance to Central Park. I turned into the park and ascended the asphalt walkway toward the park's interior. Two blue jays chased each other around one of the trees, dipping and whizzing between its barren branches, hiding from each other on opposite sides of the large trunk. Sparrows searched for food in the dry and frigid soil. An intermittent procession of people walked their dogs along the intersecting paths. Collies, retrievers, pugs, and poodles, all stretching themselves to the very ends of their leashes. Parents pushed bundled newborns and strollers, and cyclists sped down the park's main road, their bodies whistling through the wind. I walked up to a three-sided kiosk, which told me that I was standing at what once was the center of Seneca Village, an independent black community that existed from 1825 to 1857. By 1855, the village had around 225 residents, two-thirds of whom were black. About a third were Irish immigrants, and a small group was of German descent. Evidence based on church records suggests the communities lived together peacefully, with black and white families attending baptisms together, being buried alongside one another in the same cemetery, and intermarrying. The historical significance of Seneca Village was not simply that the black people living there were free, or even that the community eventually became peacefully integrated. It was also that many of the black residents owned property. Owning property gave them stability, some measure of economic security, and as per the law passed at the 1821 Constitutional Convention, the right to vote. The village was built after a white couple, John and Elizabeth Whitehead, who owned a significant portion of the land in the area, divided their estate into smaller pieces of land and sold them as 200 separate lots. Black New Yorkers, eager to escape the density of the city and the racism that undergirded their daily lives, jumped at the opportunity to purchase small parcels of land and build a community. The Whiteheads' first sale was to a 25-year-old black shoe shiner named Andrew Williams, who purchased three plots of land for $125. That same day, Epiphany Davis, a trustee of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church, purchased a dozen plots for $578. Over the next decade and beyond, black families built homes, gardens, churches, and a school. By the 1850s, they had created a thriving community that extended from what is now 82nd Street and 89th Street, and from Central Park West to 7th Avenue. The families moving into this village knew that land ownership was the gateway to electoral and political power. In 1850, there were 71 black people who owned property in New York City, and one in five lived in Seneca Village. But by the mid-1850s, as the city expanded farther and farther north, the land the village sat on became increasingly valuable. According to public historian Cynthia Copeland, wealthy New Yorkers who had traveled to Europe and seen places like the Champs-Élysées in Paris and Kensington Gardens in London believed New York should have something similar. For many, the land was valuable, but the people living on it were not. A July 1856 article in the New York Daily Times, which would later become the New York Times, referred to the settlement as Nigger Village. So in 1855, Mayor Fernando Wood, the same mayor who would later push for New York City to secede from the Union, used the city's power of eminent domain to make the village city property, clearing out all of the village residents along with over 1,000 other people who had settled in Central Park, including farmers and squatters. Though many residents initially resisted the order, unwilling to give up homes and land they had spent years building for what they considered paltry compensation, the people of Seneca Village were removed by force in the fall of 1857. Another New York Daily Times article, from about a decade later, described the scene. The supremacy of law was upheld by the policemen's bludgeons, and with many broken heads and ensanguined eyes. Then commenced the laborers of the park engineers and surveyors. There are no photographs of Seneca Village. So much of what historians imagine is based on conjecture gleaned from small pieces of evidence discovered over the years. I looked around and saw two playgrounds within a 100-yard radius of the kiosk. A young girl was flinging her legs into the sky on a swing to my left, shouting for her father to watch her soar back and forth. I thought of the families almost two centuries ago who had begun building a life on this land, and how abruptly and callously it had been taken away from them. 50 feet from where I stood was where one of Seneca Village's churches once sat. I closed my eyes and imagined the songs echoing from a building that had been torn down and replaced by oak trees and rolling hills. I thought about the homes that had been scattered across this stretch of land, and I turned around to look at the apartments that cost millions of dollars. I walked farther into the park for a few minutes until I came across the Great Lawn, a 55-acre clearing where, in summers, people picnicked, played baseball, watched concerts, threw frisbees. I thought of how this place only existed because several generations ago, hundreds of black people were violently forced from their homes. I walked through the park, back to the street, teeming with the familiar sounds of the city. I had walked across this city so many times before, but now its untold story was unraveling all around me. Every corner cast a shadow of what it had once been. New York was unique in that, like Damaris had shared, it presents itself to me as a place ahead of its time. The pretense of cultural pluralism told a story that was only half true. New York City economically benefited from slavery, and the physical history of enslavement, the blood, the bodies, and the buildings constructed by them, was deeply entrenched in the soil of the city. In May of 2019, a new museum opened on Liberty Island that put forward a new interpretation of the Statue of Liberty's origin. That it was also intended, in part, to celebrate the abolition of slavery in the United States. After going through airport-like security at the harbor's terminal, I boarded the ferry, and it rumbled its way to the island where the monument has sat for more than 130 years. It had been 2 decades since I visited the Statue of Liberty, and as the ferry approached Liberty Island, I was struck by the sheer scale of it. What I quickly discovered was that no plastic replica or photograph can prepare you for how enormous the statue is, the largest in the world at the time it was built. The details, too, were more intricate than I had remembered. The creases of her robe as it drapes over her shoulder, and the folds of her sleeve as it slides down her outstretched arm. The small parts and waves in her hair, the texture of the muscles in her arms, how the crown sits like a half sun atop her head, rays reaching into the sky. Similarly, I never noticed the torch's golden flame, at least not as I did now. It was an image that felt at once so familiar and yet so profoundly new. For most of my life, the Statue of Liberty was one of a number of pieces of American iconography that seemed to memorialize an idea that had never materialized. It is a feeling I suspect many Black Americans experience with respect to pieces of history that commemorate an ideal of U.S. history. What is the Declaration of Independence but a parchment of half-truths and contradictions? What is a monument to the American Revolution if it doesn't say who was kept in chains after it ended? The Statue of Liberty is an extension of a tradition that seems to embody the contradictions of America's promise and a reminder that its promises have not always been extended to us. As the narrator in James Baldwin's 1960 short story, This Morning, This Evening, So Soon, put it, I would never know what this statue meant to others. She had always been an ugly joke for me. The commonly held narrative that the statue welcomes new immigrants to America's shores was never part of its original meaning. And the idea that the statue was meant to celebrate the promise of America is only part of the story. The man who conceived of the Statue of Liberty, Edouard René de Laboulaye, was a French law professor who was an expert on the U.S. Constitution, as well as an ardent abolitionist. After the Civil War ended and slavery was abolished with the 13th Amendment, Laboulaye proposed that France provide the United States with a gift that would both affirm their alliance and, according to the museum, lift up the cause of freedom that had manifested through emancipation. Given Laboulaye's hatred of slavery, many historians believe that the abolition of slavery was a motivating force for the project, though there is no record of him saying so explicitly. One of the first meanings of the statue had to do with abolition, but its meaning didn't stick, said historian and author of the book The Statue of Liberty, A Transatlantic Story, Edward Berenson, in a 2019 interview. As Laboulaye shared his idea with friends in France, one that he hoped might give strength to the movement of democracy back in France, he piqued the interest of sculptor Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi, who in 1871 visited the United States, making his way from coast to coast to discuss the potential project with U.S. leaders, including former Union General and then U.S. President Ulysses S. Grant. In an early model of the Statue of Liberty, then known as Liberty Enlightening the World, she was in a similar position, except that in her left hand, she clutched a pair of broken shackles, believed to symbolize the abolition of slavery, rather than the tablet we know today. By the time the final version of the statue emerged on U.S. soil in 1886, the shackles were no longer in Lady Liberty's hand, but had become small pieces of broken chains, less conspicuously at her feet and partially hidden behind her robe. In the museum, I watched a short film outlining the statue's history. Within the first minute, the film makes an explicit connection between the conception of the statue and La Boulaye's abolitionism. Farther inside the museum, a number of exhibits outline the inconsistencies of what the monument represented. The museum stated directly that, for many groups, black people, women, Chinese immigrants, and a host of others, the statue's torch of liberty did not glow for them. There was an excerpt from an 1886 editorial in the black newspaper, the Cleveland Gazette, that read, "Shove the Bartholdi statue, torch and all, into the ocean, until the liberty of this country exists for the colored man." I had never heard there might be a relationship between the statue and emancipation, and I could not remember ever seeing the chains in photos or on replicas of the statue. I found a park ranger who I thought might be able to help explain how the National Park Service communicated this history to its visitors. I wanted to confirm whether or not La Boulaye had explicitly stated that the statue was in celebration of abolition. Choosing his words carefully, the ranger reminded me that while La Boulaye was known to everyone as a fervent abolitionist, there was a legitimate reason for the statue to have been presented in a broader, less ideological context. While La Boulaye was tasked with raising money to fund the construction of the statue, his partners in the United States were raising money to fund the construction of the pedestal. Centering the story of the statue on emancipation only a few years after slavery had been abolished in the United States, the ranger suggested, would have made fundraising significantly more difficult. Centering the story instead on France and the United States' strong friendship made for a more compelling pitch to those with money, many of whom opposed black freedom. Some historians believe that there is not enough evidence to make such a claim, but historian Alan Kraut, who is the chair of the committee of historians that oversees the exhibits, seemed to agree with the ranger, stating, "There is no question that feelings between North and South were severely strained in the 1870s and 1880s, and the ranger was correct that a very explicit connection between the statue and the outcome of the Civil War would have made fundraising hard in the South. However, there is little doubt that La Boulaye saw the gift as an extension of his own abolitionist sentiments. He was the president of the French Anti-Slavery Society. In the end, La Boulaye went with a broader, less confrontational design. I thank the ranger for our brief exchange and made my way back outside toward the statue. Dozens of languages commingled in the island's crisp afternoon air. I walked to the edge of the water in front of the statue and looked up. I could see the small specks of people moving around the pedestal, providing me with a new sense of scale for the size of the statue. But from this angle, I couldn't see the statue's feet and couldn't see the chains beside them. As I looked around the perimeter, I actually couldn't see any place from which someone would be able to see the chains. They weren't only partially hidden beneath her robe, it seemed that they were fully hidden to anyone who wasn't viewing the statue from a helicopter. I looked at the tablet in Lady Liberty's left hand and considered, for a moment, how different the statue would have been in both design and symbolism if there were broken shackles in that hand instead. There were only a few ferries left back to Manhattan before the park would close, so I made my way to the dock and boarded the next one, taking a seat on the boat's second level near a window. As the ferry pulled away, I peered through the glass and took one last look at the statue before it began shrinking into a distant silhouette of itself. My eyes moved to Lady Liberty's feet, and I thought I could see the faint contours of broken chains. But I might also have imagined seeing them, because I finally knew they were there. Gorée Island. One slave is too much. On a mild autumn morning in downtown Dakar, Senegal, I met Momar Niang, who would accompany me to Gorée Island as a translator. More than a decade ago, I had come to this island and toward the famous residence that sat at its edge. Memory, for me, is often a home where the furniture has been rearranged one too many times. Years after my initial visit, I remember less about the texture of the walls in this faded pink house and more about how the tightness of its small rooms hugged my body. I remember little of what color the sky was that day, but I remember the sound of the ocean washing over the rocks at the island's rocky perimeter. I do not remember specifically what the guide said about the people kept in these rooms, but I remember how his words poured concrete into my chest. Momar was educated at Cheikh Anta Diop University in Dakar and is now a journalist living on the outskirts of the city. Tall and thin, he glided as he walked, his pace unhurried, his chin tilted up just so, a match for his easy smile and patient temperament. He was not bald, but kept his hair cut close to his scalp, and a thin mustache sat above his lips. English was his third language, as it is for many people in Dakar, who count the local Wolof and French as the primary means of communication, and he spoke with a fluency that was in contrast to my bumbling, inelegant French. I had studied French in school for many years, but a decade of using the language sparingly had rendered it unfamiliar. It met my tongue awkwardly. The French spoken in Senegal carries the crown of Wolof on every syllable. Sentences are a carousel of language, the words wrapping around one another before drifting apart again. It took a while to reacquaint myself with the intimacy of the language's movements, the memory of how my mouth was meant to curl and bend in ways English did not require. Downtown Dakar was bustling and vibrant. Sauntering bodies jostled at the edges of dusty street corners, while cars swept between one another, coiling the road in a garland of exhaust. Minibuses teeming with passengers swerved around corners with alacrity and precision, their exteriors bursting with color, the blues, yellows, oranges, and reds bleeding together as they accelerated by. People crossed the street with purpose, moving between the taxis and minibuses they presumed would stop for them. The smell of baguettes and roasted nuts snuck through the exhaust, letting my body know that the apple I had eaten for breakfast was not enough. Every sound, every smell, was a layer of fog lifting itself to reveal a memory I had forgotten was there. As we walked through downtown, Momar, who was 39, said, "I've never been to the slave house before." His voice was coated with the texture of cigarette smoke. I turned my head toward him as we stopped at the curb of the street before crossing. "I guess it was shameful for me," he added. To get to Gorée Island, we took a ferry from the edge of Dakar across a small slice of the Atlantic Ocean. The traffic circles near the harbor spun in an unceasing cycle, the car's sharp horns an orchestra of vibrant noise. When we arrived at the docking station, we found a room of tourists, vendors, and school children bringing the cavernous space to life. There were no seats left in the room, so Momar and I stood in the corner toward the back. I returned our conversation to what he had said before, that he had felt too ashamed to go to the Maison des Esclaves, or House of Slaves. "I don't know exactly why," he said, his voice searching. "Maybe I was intimidated by the fact of seeing chains and the rustling of chains. It's a very sad history, and not visiting for me is maybe to try to forget the story." More people streamed into the room, and Momar posited a counterfactual. "Sometimes I will ask myself a question. I could be now an American. My ancestors. I could be part of those who had been taken away. I thought of how a family, separated by an ocean, would have the arc of their lineages forever changed." "It's a problem of fate or destiny," Momar added. "I'm also seeing that we have a link with Black Americans, and they come from Africa. And if you see a Black American, and his ancestors had the misfortune to be captured by the slave master, here in Africa, we should not say that we were lucky." "No, we were not lucky. It's a tragedy. It's a real tragedy." Even though Momar had thus far been unable to bring himself to visit the House of Slaves, he told me he knew that he and his country must forcefully confront the story it tells. "We should not shy away from it. We have to study this story. This is part of our collective memory, and also to introduce all the coming generations to this story in a very unbiased way. What I mean is, we have to talk about the responsibility of the colonizers, those who came to take slaves and brought them to the Americas and Brazil, etc. But also, It is the responsibility of Africans. I asked Momar how the history of the slave trade was taught in Senegalese schools. He said the topic was not discussed in as much depth as it needed to be. We have to identify in the curriculum somehow some special classes dedicated to slavery, he said, and that it should be done at the primary stage and not waiting to when you are in high school, because it's very important. And I think if you are introduced to the story earlier, this is the best way. Otherwise, he said, people fail to understand the historical realities that shape the history and trajectory of this country. When the ferry arrived, everyone moved briskly through the door leading to the dock. At the edge of the dock, the ferry rose and fell in the water. It was a medium-sized white vessel with two levels that looked as if it might hold about 200 people, as long as half of those people were willing to stand. A cloth awning stretched tightly over the top of the boat as the ship moved with steady force over the water, its engine's unremitting hum vibrating under our feet. It took about 15 minutes to cross over from the mainland to the island. Stepping off the boat, I encountered a landscape of startling beauty. The homes on the island were arranged in uneven rows of weathered pastels, yellow peeling into green, orange washing into pink, blue flaking off to reveal the eggshell underneath. Green vines climbed the sides of the building's stone walls, and each of the house's rooftops was a coronet of red shingles. Clothes dangled from lines of laundry, a necklace of wet garments stringing each house together. Behind the homes, a cluster of lush trees ascended a hill toward the highest point of the island. Palm trees on the water's edge whipped themselves into a gentle frenzy, and along the island's waterfront stood a stretch of restaurants serving poulet yassa, chebouyap, and mafé poisson. In striking contrast to the busy city just 3 kilometers behind us, no cars are allowed on the small island. The sound of the ocean was the backdrop for all conversations. From an aerial view, Gore Island looks like a small hook. The Portuguese arrived on the island as early as the 1440s and set up a trading post there not long after. Its position just off the west coast of the Senegambia region made it a place of strategic importance for trade, and a place where European ships could restock supplies before leaving the continent. European powers spent 2 centuries fighting for control of Gore, which was occupied in succession by the Portuguese, Dutch, British, and French. As the island's colonizers changed, so did its name. The Senegalese call the island Beira. The Portuguese called it Ilha de Palma. The Dutch changed its name to Roda Reda, meaning good port. The French, who officially took charge of the territory in 1677 and who would largely maintain control until Senegalese independence in 1960, amended it to Île de Gorée. The island was a site of the slave trade from the 16th century, when it was under Portuguese control and slaves were part of its economy, until 1848, when, under French control, France abolished slavery in all its colonies. For decades, Gore Island was thought of as the central point of departure for enslaved people leaving West Africa and headed to the New World. It was also a place from which captured Africans could not easily escape, as the small body of land was surrounded by water. So sweeping was its global reputation that in 1978, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, also known as UNESCO, named Gore a World Heritage Site. In the more than 40 years since it has received that designation, it has become an even more popular site of interest for tourists visiting the region and of pilgrimage for those attempting to reckon with the history of chattel slavery. In 1981, Michel Rocard, who would later become the French Prime Minister, visited the House of Slaves, and after being shown the place where the bodies were said to have been held before their final departure, he said, "It is not easy for a white man, in all honesty, to visit this slave house without feeling ill at ease." Renowned activist Angela Davis visited the island in 1990, writing in the House of Slaves guestbook, "To return home, to relive the profound suffering of my ancestors, to know that humanity's worst crimes were committed at this site, it must never happen again." Pope John Paul II visited the island in 1992 and went on to ask forgiveness for the role Christians played in maintaining and perpetuating the slave trade. The island has been visited by U.S. Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. On his 2013 visit with his family, President Obama wrote in the site's guestbook, "We are grateful for the opportunity to learn more about the painful history of the slave trade and to help remind us of the need to remain vigilant on behalf of the rights of all humankind." As Momar and I stepped from the dock onto the island, we and anyone who looked even vaguely like a foreigner were inundated with people offering to take us on a tour of the island. We were stopped by a man who told us that we needed to go to a small building on our left to pay a tax for the island, which left us confused because there were groups of people walking by who were not being stopped and directed that way. Not wanting to make a big deal of it, we went to the small station on our left, where we paid a woman a small tax of 500 Sefa francs, the equivalent of a little less than a dollar. At this station, we asked one of the men near us if he knew where the House of Slaves was located. The man nodded and said he would bring us there. What we did not realize was that he had now taken on the role of our guide. Sam was tall with dark skin and transition lens glasses that gave him an enigmatic air. He wore a long white boo-boo with gold trim and a pair of blue shoes coated in a thin layer of dust. Sam did not speak much English, so Momar translated as we discussed the history and aesthetics of the island. I told Sam that we didn't necessarily need the full tour of the island, much of which entailed bringing us to different artists and vendors who would attempt to sell us their work. While their art was often beautiful, I had come here for a specific reason. I hoped Sam would simply show us where the House of Slaves was. He did little to hide his disappointment, but signaled for us to follow him. When we arrived at the House of Slaves, the first thing I saw was a pair of staircases. The symmetrical curves of both staircases were bordered by faded pink half-walls that served as handrails. Open to the elements, the stone was worn from years of weather and thousands of grazing hands. Stone columns at the top of the staircases held up the roof, while behind sat a row of white French doors, their shutters open like an invitation. The house was undergoing renovations when we visited, and the workers continued their construction while visitors made their way through the rest of the structure. Sawdust spilled between the cracks of wood-paneled ceilings, golden flecks dancing downward in soft spirals. Wheelbarrows full of wet concrete cackled over cobbled stones. The percussion of hammers hitting nails reverberated in the air. The House of Slaves was once the residence of a woman named Anna Colas Pepin. Pepin was what was then known as a signaire, a term used to describe a wealthy African or mixed-race French-African woman, often the wife of a European man, an alliance that ushered signaires into a higher social class than Africans. Signaires, including Pepin, often owned and traded enslaved people themselves. In 1960, when Senegal became independent of France, President Léopold Sédar Senghor encouraged Babacar Joseph Ndiaye, who lived on the island, to begin research on the house and its relationship to the slave trade. Ndiaye renamed the residence the Maison des Esclaves, or House of Slaves, and served as the curator from 1962 until his death in 2009. Historian Deborah Mack writes that it was Ndiaye who came up with the concept of the Door of No Return, which serves as the centerpiece for Gore's story. The Door of No Return is a famous symbol of the slave trade, appearing at historical sites across the western coast of Africa. The story goes that it was through these doors, looking out onto the Atlantic, that millions of enslaved Africans walked as they boarded ships that would bring them into bondage on the other side of the ocean. Momar, Sam, and I were not alone in the house. The other groups of people spoke softly to one another in a range of different languages, their respective guides gesturing to different elements of the house. Directly across from me, I saw the Door of No Return open toward the sea. My toes reached out over the door's edge as the breeze from the ocean swept in and tickled my ears. The air tasted of salt and sun, while the blue-green water of the Atlantic glittered in the midday light. Small flecks of mist jumped from the rocks and kissed my cheeks. Seagulls traced the shoreline with their shadows, their bodies hovering just above the water. I watched as dozens of them lifted their beaks, rose, tucked their wings, and plunged their bodies into the ocean, then rose back out of the water, some small fish wriggling in their mouths. The thrum of the ferry's engine pulsed in the distance, with a smattering of smaller fishing boats circling the island in search of a place to cast their nets. Beneath me, The low tide washed over the rocks on the shore, the stones once sharp edges rounded by the centuries-long kiss of salt water. I stood and looked at these rocks, at this shoreline, losing track of time staring into the ocean. I eventually stepped back from the door, my own shadow evaporating into the wall as my body moved away from the light. On either side of the door were two narrow rooms where Sam said enslaved people were held before being forced onto slave ships. As I did in the old prison cell at Angola, I extended my arms between the walls. Here, my elbow touched one wall while the fingers at the end of my opposite arm grazed the other side. The stone wall was both dirty and wet, leaving my fingertips marked with a thin layer of black grime. I placed the heels of my feet at the base of the wall at one end of the room and walked until my toes hit the wall on the other side. I counted 6 steps. Though it was the middle of the day, the chamber was bathed in darkness, but for the light that crept in from 2 long, thin openings in the exterior wall. The wind cut through those small gaps and pierced the air inside. Outside the rooms, Sam pointed to an opening in the wall beneath the set of stairs with Salut des Recalcitrants written over the top of it. This is where they kept the slaves who resisted, Momar translated for me. It was too dark to tell what it looked like. I turned on my phone's flashlight, bent down, and scooted inside. The stone seemed to almost absorb the light, so it still felt dark inside the shallow cavern. I waited for my eyes to adjust to the darkness. They did not. I hugged my knees close to my chest as I sat inside. The joints in my knees and ankles cracked. Dirt fell from the wall where I touched it. It was impossible to feel as if the walls weren't closing in on me. I thought of people being held here, how they might barely have been able to see their hands in front of their faces, how they would have been able to taste the salt water that hung in the air without seeing any of the ocean. I thought about all the times I had heard, "But why didn't they just fight back?" when slavery was discussed in my classes. I thought of the bell at plantations like the Whitney, which had been rung to tell enslaved people to gather round and watch one of their loved ones being lashed until they bled. I thought of the rooms in Angola's Red Hat cell block, how the smallness of those spaces had closed in on me. The cramped cavern might have been where the lessons on first resistance had taken place in a person's earliest days of enslavement, where spirits and bodies had been broken. I found Elwa Koli, the curator and site manager of the House of Slaves, behind a desk covered with stacks of books, newspapers, notepads, and a small Senegalese flag near a telephone at the desk corner. The walls of the room were pink like the rest of the house, the paint's worn coat peeling to reveal the gray-white concrete underneath. Around us were photographs of famous visitors who had made their way here, many capturing Elwa shaking their hands or guiding them around the house. Elwa had a large frame and wore a gold-green boubou with a pattern of red stripes intersecting with one another. He was bald, with thick glasses, the small streaks of sun gleaming off his head and reflecting from his eyes. Slices of light peeked into the room, sneaking past a thin blue curtain. Momar took a seat in the corner of the room, and Sam waved goodbye and went on his way. Elwa began his career at one of the biggest high schools in Dakar as a cultural advisor, and in the mid-1980s, he became assistant curator of the House of Slaves. After the 2009 passing of his longtime supervisor, Boubacar Joseph Ndiaye, Elwa became the curator. As of our conversation, he had been working at the site for about 35 years, making the House of Slaves and Gorée Island the center of his life. Even though he has the option to live in Dakar, as many of the people who work on the island do, he instead has chosen to live next door to the house. Living in such proximity to the house allows Elwa to fully live his commitment to ensure that this site is a place where people are made to confront the history of the transatlantic slave trade. "I believe that it's very important to keep the memory," he said to me directly in English, preferring not to use Momar. "How to keep this memory and how to teach what's happened. How to talk more about all the violations of human rights." Elwa told me that the island was not originally a place Europeans intended to use to capture and sell enslaved Africans. As I had read, Gorée was coveted by European nations because of its strategic value as a trading post for the alleged trove of resources in West Africa. The purpose was not to find slaves, he said. The purpose was discovery. Many of the other European nations came to Goree Island to fight each other, just so they could occupy the place, he told me. It wasn't until the inception of slavery in the Americas, Elwa said, that the purpose of Goree Island changed. After the discovery of America, because of the development of sugarcane plantations, cotton, coffee, rice cultivation, they forced the Native Americans to work for them. And it was because the natives died in great number that they turned to Africa. And the purpose was to replace these natives with Africans. As slavery became central to the economic prosperity of the United States, increasing numbers of Africans were imported from the Senegambia region. I thought about something Yvonne had told me during my tour of the Whitney Plantation, how many of the enslaved people in southern Louisiana were from the Senegambia region, and how they possessed specific knowledge about cultivating rice and indigo seeds. It was not impossible, I thought, that someone who had passed through a door on Goree Island would have ended up on the Whitney Plantation. As the desire for enslaved people increased, Europeans had to justify the human plunder. In order to rationalize taking a person from their home, separating them from their family, and shipping them across an ocean to work in a system of intergenerational bondage, Elwa said, these Europeans could not see these Africans as people. They considered black Africans not as human beings, but as simple merchandise, Elwa said. If they consider Africans as merchandise, that is because they understand the necessity to dehumanize Africans in order to work for the acceptance by all the Europeans. The necessity to use Africans because Africans are not human beings. Elwa continued, noting that this heinous industry required partnerships with leaders of certain African tribal groups. During the 16th century, Africans used only arrows, not firearms. So Europeans came with firearms, alcohol, and iron they would give to the African tribes living in and along the coast. Elwa said that during the African tribal wars, various factions fought one another. The white Europeans were more than happy to give guns to these different groups. They cared less about who was fighting than about the payment they received in exchange. Humans, the prisoners of war who had been captured from other tribes. The only currency that was accepted by Europeans, Elwa said, his voice punctuating each word, was slaves. This created a cycle in which certain tribes were encouraged to capture even more prisoners of war in order to sell those prisoners to Europeans for more guns and other goods. Elwa wanted to make clear, however, that this was not necessarily a widespread practice. Not all Africans were involved in the slave trade, he said. Many, he told me, organized themselves to resist the Europeans and fought to maintain sovereignty and control over their land and their people. He also rejected the idea that Africans were as culpable as their European counterparts. It was the Europeans who organized this, he said. Africans didn't know what the final destination was. Elwa sees himself as part of a movement that is not only helping the world reckon with the history of the slave trade, but also helping Senegal present a history that does not begin with slavery and colonization. Elwa wants the public discourse to account for the continent's extensive history, a history that began before Western exploitation. In Senegal, we are rewriting the history on Senegal from the origin until now. But it is something very difficult. They told us that black is nothing. His voice hovered over the final word. They tried to forget that things start in Africa, he said. The slave trade or colonization was not the starting point of Africa. This forgetting, Elwa said, has deleteriously affected the collective self-esteem of African peoples. He noted that Senegal, along with other West African countries, has to make sure that it teaches a history that highlights who black people were before slavery and who they are in spite of it. We have to use education to deconstruct in order to reconstruct, he said. Africans have to know that the starting point was Africa. When I first arrived in Senegal in 2009, I was told that millions of people passed through the door of no return on their way to the New World. A story that hundreds of thousands of visitors to Goree have been told for decades, and one promoted by the House of Slaves' original curator, Boubacar, Joseph, and Ndai. The claim did not end with Ndai. It was an assertion supported by the United Nations agency UNESCO, which at the time of this writing still states on its World Heritage listing for Gorée Island that from the 15th to the 19th century, it was the largest slave trading center on the African coast. After additional research, however, it has become clear that these numbers were deeply inaccurate. Scholars now estimate that it was closer to 33,000 enslaved people who passed through Gorée. To be sure, 33,000 people is an extraordinary number, but it is not consistent with the millions originally said to have passed through the House of Slaves alone. The island of Gorée hosted a melange of people, including domestic enslaved people, captured enslaved people meant for transit to the New World, free Africans, signers, slave traders, and soldiers. It was not singularly used as a mechanism of the slave trade. Lewis Nelson, an architectural historian and vice provost at the University of Virginia who has spent time working at Gorée, would later tell me, in our assessment of that building, we found one chamber that was likely the holding cell for human beings, would have held maybe 15 or 20 people at max, though the story often told on the island was that some of them held hundreds. Nelson had been part of an international team of researchers who had conducted research on the island and studied the House of Slaves and its history in partnership with local curators. There also were pens, so there were dedicated buildings on Gorée for the containment of large numbers of people, he said. And then lastly, those people are going to be marched in coffles down to the docks. So that door of no return that you stood in, that Barack Obama stood in, and that the Pope stood in, he paused briefly. That door probably never really led to ships. His voice dropped an octave. More likely, he said, that was the place where waste was thrown into the sea. I brought the numbers up with Elwa, who paused, looking, it seemed, for the right words. You know that in this small island of Gorée, the slave house where we are is not the only one. During the full period of slavery, there were more than 20 houses like this. But this one belonged to the Senegalese state, who purchased this house to better know exactly what happened during the slave trade. That's why, today, the slave house crystallizes all of the slave trade. He looked at me, head down, eyes peering over his glasses. It's a symbol of the slave trade. I could not tell if Elwha was intentionally sidestepping or if he had not fully understood because of the language barrier. I asked Elwha again about the discrepancy in numbers from scholars and the story that had long been told at the House of Slaves. The number of slaves is not important when you talk about memory, he said. When we talk about memory, we have to stand in the principles. One slave is too much. There are scholars who agree with Elwha. When considering the story of Gorée Island, historical anthropologist François Richard finds it helpful to use a term coined by the renowned sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, calling Gorée a site of sincere fiction. According to Richard, the statistical controversy of Gorée Island cannot and should not undermine its place as a site of memory and reckoning. Richard told the Washington Post that he believes turning the question of international slavery into a statistical exercise is not the most useful way to think about it. And sadly, that legacy has clouded academic debates more than it has helped. I continued to try to get clarification. So, you see the slave house as a symbol of something that was a much broader phenomenon. It's a place where we can remember and reckon with and learn about and think about the history of slavery? Yes, Elwha said, with a sigh that fell somewhere between frustration and relief. Elwha's point could apply to historical sites across the world. The physical place, the land people come and stand upon, is an entry point to a much broader history, of which any single location is but one piece. Elwha believes that every country in West Africa should have a gathering place like this one to memorialize history. He described it as a place of remembrance. I couldn't help but think about whether that symbolism of Gorée Island was undermined by the inaccuracies that undergirded it. There were still people on Gorée sharing information with tourists as if the data was unimpeachable. In truth, this data has been disputed by scholars for years now. How could this place be a symbol of history, but fail to ensure the history that it conveyed was factual? Nelson told me later, Elwha bears a responsibility, socially and culturally, to affirm the legacy of the position he inherited, and to simply dispense with or unseat a legacy that the nation looks to is not done easily. His language was deliberate, long silences punctuating every few words. He was given this story and given the responsibility of shepherding and stewarding this very important site for national identity, national consciousness. And to completely invert that would be a very difficult thing to do. Nelson also said that it is important for European and American scholars to be careful and consider whether there is a responsibility to be deferential to local interpretations. To come into a place one doesn't have any familial or cultural connection to and upend the story it is told for decades is likely to be more harmful than helpful. The story of Goree, Nelson said, is not as simple as which empirical evidence is correct or incorrect. There is a range of ethical, cultural, and social factors to consider when interpreting the historical significance of a site like the House of Slaves. I think one has to tread very carefully in the dissemination of that alternative interpretation, because to do so, I think, actually bears the ethical responsibility of relationship building, Nelson said. If you're going to purport to tell the story of a place, you need to have relationships of trust in that place. I just think that that's a fundamental operational commitment. Historian Ana Lucia Araujo told me that the story of the House of Slaves could be traced back to the original curator, Boubacar Joseph Ndai. Ndai, she noted, sought to fill a gap in the world's collective memory when there was little social will or physical infrastructure to catalyze this memory. Ndai, she said, started playing the role of witness. We do not have anybody who witnessed the Atlantic slave trade among us anymore, she told me after I had returned from my trip, whereas something like the Holocaust had victims who were, and still are, able to tell us this story. It is not necessarily that Araujo thinks Ndai was willfully untruthful. In the 1960s, when the story began to emerge, there was little evidence to undergird or corroborate any of the claims. The story took on a life of its own, independent of empirics. Araujo likes to think of Ndai as a sort of griot, a person who used the power of storytelling to force people to confront a larger history many had forgotten or were willing to ignore. He would guide people and generated this kind of emotion, she said. The problem was this story, embedded within a larger social, cultural, and political project, became the official narrative repeated across the world. Soon, the story Ndai told was being supported by official bodies like UNESCO, lending ostensible validation to the story even when there wasn't evidence to support the numbers it purported. This is the problem of the memory of slavery, that we have all these gaps, Araujo said, and you need to fill those gaps with something. It isn't only Senegal that struggles with what reckoning looks like, Araujo reminded me. When Araujo first came to the U.S. from Brazil, she was struck by how the homes of presidents like Washington and Jefferson were privately owned and operated rather than being run by the National Park Service. From her perspective, this makes it difficult for the U.S. to tell a cohesive story about its past, as each place can situate itself in the past in its own way. In other words, they can tell the story they want, she said. And I think that from this point of view, we have no grounds to judge what is being done elsewhere. Elwha had been to the United States on a number of occasions and recalled a particular trip he took that was sponsored by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. This trip included a tour through different historical sites in the South. The experience, he recounted, helped him better understand the connection between West Africans and Black people in the Southern United States. A part of the African heritage combined with what they found overseas, and that is what gives us African American culture, he said. Elwha said that he also visited several plantations while he was there. I asked him what had stayed with him following his visit. He was struck by what he referred to as the continuation of the dehumanization of Africans. He said, the problem that they have in the plantations is that they continue to tell more about the owner of the property, but they didn't focus on what has happened to the slaves. That is why it is difficult in the plantations to interest African Americans. I told him about the Whitney plantation's attempt to turn the narrative on its head. He was familiar with their work, he said, and hoped to come to the United States to visit the Whitney and the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. He hopes that Goree Island will be able to partner with plantations like the Whitney in order to provide visitors with both the point of origin and the destination of the transatlantic slave trade, helping them to understand how this happened and why we cannot let it ever happen again. Elwha believes this work is essential in combating the dominant narratives that have shaped our world's understanding of what slavery was. He leaned back in his chair and crossed his arms. History is written by the perpetrators, he said, and his goal is to be a part of writing something that challenges that. Momar and I decided to get some lunch before leaving on the last ferry of the day. We walked through a series of narrow alleyways, pebbles crunching under our feet. On a street near the northern tip of the island, Momar stopped me and pointed to a sign that read, Rue du Boufflers. This road is named after Stanislas de Boufflers, Momar said. Boufflers had been the French colonial governor of Senegal in the late 18th century. And there is currently a debate among civil society which is directed around the fact that we should rename the streets of Dakar, because all of the streets are named after some French personalities who were here during colonization. Momar transitioned from an observational tone to an assertive one. It's time to give our streets the name of our heroes, because we do have heroes in Africa. As Momar spoke, a little boy who could have only been 5 or 6 rounded the corner, chasing the call of his mother several paces ahead of him. Momar nodded in the boy's direction. It's time to change, and the change should begin with the symbols, because the young boy will soon ask, who is Boufflers? As I watched that little boy turn the corner, and as I listened to Momar, I thought of how at that moment, there might be little black boys just like this one in New Orleans, running down a street named after Robert E. Lee. How there might have been little black girls in Mississippi, running down roads named after Nathan Bedford Forrest. How there might have been black children in Georgia, wandering down streets named after Jefferson Davis. I thought about the parallels between the debate in Senegal over the remnants of colonialism and the debate in the United States over the remnants of slavery. It's like the conversation that we're having in the U.S. about the Confederate monuments, I said to Momar. The monuments are statues of people who fought the war for the South to keep slavery, but they're up all over. People say, why are these statues up of people who were fighting to keep slavery? That doesn't make any sense. So people are trying to get them taken down now. That's our version. It's very similar, he said, nodding. He told me about a controversy that had played out at a university in Ghana the year before, surrounding a statue of Mahatma Gandhi, who, he paused and laughed in anticipation of the euphemism he was about to use, talked badly about black people. And you know, the students came one day to put down the statue, and there was a whole lot of fuss in the university, and some people were against it. You know, this guy's like, he's a racist, and we have to take it off. He continued, we even are saying the same thing in Senegal, because our ancient capital is in Saint-Louis, and in the very middle of the city, you've got a statue of Governor Louis Federbe, and people are saying, no, this is not good. We are now independent since 1960. Saint-Louis, as was common for many parts of the French colonial project, was named after the French king, Louis IX. Momar believes these names, these symbols, and these statues hang like a weight around his country's neck. We have to take all this, he stretched his arms wide and looked up at the street sign again, all that is supposed to symbolize the French domination. They should be separated. As we rode the ferry back to Dakar, a smoky dust was settling over the city's skyline. An endless swath of construction projects shot dirt and cement powder up toward the clouds, knitting the horizon in threads of orange and brown. Water lapped against the front of the boat as it pushed forward, the small white waves it made moving outward before disappearing into the endless blue. I had one more day in Senegal and wanted to go back to Goree. Momar agreed to accompany me again and as we waited for the ferry to arrive early the next morning, the day's new light softened everything it touched. I asked Momar what his impression of Gore Island had been yesterday. He took a deep breath and leaned forward in his chair, placing his elbows on his thighs. "Yes, quite a discovery," he said. "I was very struck by the place, and how the walls are wet, and how the rooms are small and tiny, and I was just searching myself at the place of those who have suffered." He looked to his left and his right, as if to mime what he had done in the house yesterday. "I was putting myself back in the 17th century. I was trying to imagine on how we can treat the human being like this, and how we can pack so many people in such small places. And all around, it's like I can feel the pain myself." Momar had been cautious, it seemed, taking something in and then stepping back as if to avoid psychological and sensory overload. In the docking station, a baby near us cooed in discomfort. Her mother cradled the new child, readjusting her arms and bouncing her gently. Momar told me that he kept thinking of the children ensnared in slavery's grip. He said he couldn't imagine the speed with which illness would have spread, or the fear that these children would have felt. He became quiet again and stared at a spot ahead of us on the floor. We waited for the ferry to arrive. We walked through a series of alleyways and past homes that signaled we were leaving the tourist-centered part of the island. The school we were visiting sat at the eastern edge of the island, and I marveled at its backdrop, how the ocean water caught and held the light when the sun was at its peak, how you could not tell the difference between where the ocean ended and the sky began. Founded in 1977 by the newly independent country's first president, Leopold Sédar Senghor, and named after the acclaimed Senegalese author and feminist Mariama Ba, the Maison d'Education Mariama Ba, with an all-female student population, is one of the top boarding schools in Senegal. Around us, the sound of school children transitioning classes consumed the air, their sandals shuffling along the sandy floors, desks being dragged across classrooms, backpacks zipping and being flung over shoulders. Hassan Khan is the school's history teacher. He met us in a lush courtyard, wearing an orange and yellow plaid short-sleeved shirt tucked into a pair of dark brown khakis. His voice was soft and his eyes were wide, and light gleamed off the top of his dark scalp. Hassan exuded a calmness we hope for in anyone teaching young people, his voice holding space for both patience and conviction. He led us to an empty classroom on the second floor, where we sat around the desk at the front. Hassan spoke English well, but I still had trouble capturing the specific nuances of what he was attempting to say in his third language. I told him to communicate in whatever language best allowed him to express his sentiments, and if it was French, Momar would simply translate for me. Hassan began our conversation in English, then switched to French, with Momar intermittently pausing in order to effectively translate. Hassan said he was constantly attempting to find a balance, helping his students understand the heinous implications of slavery without letting them fall into a state of paralysis. It was important that this history be taught, he thought, but the end result could not be young people thinking of themselves or their ancestors solely as oppressed, exploited people who could never escape the legacy of Western subjugation. He wanted his students to understand it, but he did not want them to be defined by it. "It's important to go beyond this view between victims and perpetrators," he said, adding that tackling this history would help students understand the implications of slavery in the present day. Echoing Elwa, Hassan emphasized a central part of his pedagogy, teaching his students that Africa's history did not begin with slavery. "You must," he said, "present how Africa was before slavery, and how it is during slavery, and how it is after slavery." Hassan continued, "If you want to understand the economic situation in Africa, you have to understand what happened during slavery and how slavery has got a huge impact because slavery has deprived us of the first input for development, which is the human force. We have to understand how colonization impacted negatively on our situation and also how slavery deprived Africa of its workforce." Part of what Hassan teaches his students is that we cannot understand slavery and colonialism as two separate historical phenomena. They are inextricably linked pieces of history. Slavery took a toll on West Africa's population. Millions of people were stripped from their homelands and sent across the ocean to serve in intergenerational bondage. The profound harm continued during colonialism, with much of the continent stripped of its natural resources instead of its people. Hassan reflected, in both situations, in slavery and colonization, what you have is a system of plunder. First, in slavery, we have a plunder of human beings. Africa had been ripped of its people. In colonization, is a plunder of natural resources. We have been exploited by the colonizers. On both systems, what you have is a plunder system. In Hassan's voice, I could hear the echoes of Walter Rodney, the Guyanese historian and political activist who wrote in his 1972 book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, every African has a responsibility to understand the system and work for its overthrow. What Hassan was doing was providing his students with the guidance to understand the history of their country so they might build something better. There is a phrase that Hassan believed captured the essence of the entanglement between capitalism, colonialism, and slavery. White sugar means black misery. He said, if Europe is what it is nowadays, it's because of the blood and efforts of Africans who have been taken to America to work on plantations and generate profits. It favored the industrial development of Europe, since part of Europe's development was made possible by the fact that we sent to America slaves who worked hard to create development. That's the root of Europe's current development. I was curious to hear what he thought of reparations. What might it mean for his people to be compensated for the lives stolen and resources plundered? Hassan took in a deep breath and tucked his lips into his mouth before speaking. It's still a debate here. And opinions are diverse, he said in English, not using Momar to translate this time. Hassan emphasized that the question was not whether his country deserved reparations, but, not unlike the debate in the United States, what are we going to repair? Hassan was not opposed to figuring out the logistics of financial compensation, but he emphasized the need for a sort of moral compensation. Some people prefer a sense of memory, he said.